to the rail, then stood on tiptoe and peeked cautiously over. "Do you think it was a Keith and Croon caused the storming, Mr. Mackenzie? Grandad says it was like enough. They lash their great huge tails about you, Ken," she informed him. "That's what makes the waves go so big."
"I shouldn't be thinking such a thing myself. Where's your brothers then, Alanna?"
"Fevered,"
the girl answered indifferently. It was nothing out of the way. Half the emigrants in line were coughing and sneezing. 3 days in darkness and damp clothes have done nothing for their precarious state of health.
"Have you seen a Keith and Croon, then?"
she asked, leaning far over the rail, a hand shading her eyes.
"Are they really big enough to swallow the boat?"
"Myself has not seen one." Roger dropped his dipper and grabbed her by the apron sash, pulling her firmly off the rail. "Have a care, aye. It would take no more than a spratling to swallow you, lassie."
"Look!"
she shrieked, leaning farther over in spite of his grasp.
"Look! It is! It is!"
Drawn as much by the terror in her voice as what she said, Roger leaned over the rail involuntarily. A dark shape hovered just below the surface, smooth and black, graceful as a bullet, and half the length of the ship. It kept pace for a few moments with the racing vessel, then was outdistanced and left behind. "Shark," Roger said, shaken in spite of himself. He gave the girl a small shake to stop her steam whistle screeches. "It's no but a shark here. You ken what's a shark, do you know? We ate one only last week." She had quit shrieking, but was still white-faced and wide-eyed, tender mouth quivering.
"You're sure?" she said. It wasn't a Keith and Croon?"
"No," Roger said gently, and gave her a dipper of water to drink by herself. "Only a shark. The biggest shark he had ever seen, with an air of blind ferocity that raised the hair on his forearms to see. But only a shark." They hung about the ship whenever her speed slowed, eager for the garbage and slops tossed overboard.
"Isabel!"
An indignant cry summoned his erstwhile companion to come and lend a hand with the family chores. With dragging step and out-thrust lip, Isabel slouched off to help her mother with the water buckets, leaving Roger to finish his job without further distraction. No further distraction than his thoughts, at least. For the most part, he succeeded in forgetting that the Gloriana had nothing below her save leagues of empty water, that the ship wasn't, in fact, the small and solid island that it seemed, but instead no more than a fragile shell at the mercy of forces that could crush her in moments and everyone aboard. Had the Philip Alonso reached port in safety, he wondered. Ships did sink, and fairly often. He'd read enough accounts of it. Having lived through the last 3 days, he could only be amazed that more of them didn't sink. Well, there was precisely nothing he could do about that prospect, except pray. "For those in peril on the deep, Lord, have mercy." With sudden vividness, he understood exactly what the maker of that line had meant. Finished, he dropped the dipper into the barrel and reached for a board to cover the open top. Rats tended to fall in and drown otherwise. One of the women clutched him by the arm as he turned away. She gestured at the little boy she held, fussing against his mother's neck.
"Mr. Mackenzie, might the captain gie us a wee rub wi' his ring? Our Gibby has a touch of sore eyes from being in the dark so long."
Roger hesitated, but then ridiculed himself. He, like the rest of the crew, tended to steer clear of Bonnet, but there was no reason to refuse the woman's request. The captain had obliged before with a rub of his gold ring, this being a popular remedy for sore eyes and inflammations.
"Yeah, sure," he said, forgetting himself for a moment. "Come on."
The woman blinked in surprise, but followed him obediently. The captain was on his quarter-deck, engaged in close conversation with the mate. Roger motioned to the woman to wait for a bit, and she nodded, shrinking modestly behind him. The captain looked as tired as any of them, the lines of dissipation carved deeper in his face. Lucifer, after a week of running hell and finding it no picnic, Roger thought, sourly amused. "Damage to the tea chests," Bonnet was saying to the mate.
"Only two, and not soaked through," Dixon replied. "We can salvage a bit, maybe get rid of it upriver in Cross Creek."
"Aye. They're more particular in Edenton and New Bern. We'll get the best prices there, though. We'll get rid of what we can before we go to Wilmington."
Bonnet turned slightly and caught sight of Roger. His expression hardened, but relaxed again when he heard the request. Without comment, he reached down and rubbed the gold ring he wore on his little finger gently over little Gilbert's closed eyes. A plain wide band, Roger saw. It almost looked like a wedding ring, though smaller. A woman's ring, maybe?
The formidable Bonnet with a love token?
Could be, Roger supposed. Some women might find the captain's air of subdued violence attractive.
"The wean's ailing," Dixon remarked.
He pointed. There was a prickle of red bumps behind the boy's ears, and his pale cheeks bloomed with fever.
"No buttermilk fever,"
the woman said, pulling her child defensively against her bosom.
"He's a new tooth coming, likely."
The captain nodded indifferently and turned away. Roger escorted the woman to the galley to beg a bit of hard biscuit for the child to gnaw on, then sent her back to the forward hold with the others. He had little thought for Gilbert's gums, though. As he climbed the ladderway to the deck, his mind was occupied by the conversation he had overheard. Stops in New Bern and Edenton before Wilmington. And plainly Bonnet was in no rush. He'd be looking for good prices for his cargo, and taking the time to broker the indentures of his passengers. Christ, it could be weeks before they made Wilmington. It wouldn't do, Roger thought. God knew where Brianna could get to, or what sort of thing happened to her. The Gloriana had made swift passage in spite of the squall. God willing, they'd make North Carolina in only 8 weeks if the winds held. He didn't want to sacrifice the valuable time so gained to lallygagging in the Northern Carolina ports, mooching their way south. He'd be off the Gloriana in the first port they touched, he resolved, and make his way south as best he could. True, he'd given his word to stay with the ship until the cargo was disposed of, but then he wouldn't be taking his wages either, so the exchange seemed fair enough. The fresh cold air above decks did a little bit to rouse him. His head still felt stuffed with damp cotton wool, though, and the back of his throat was raspy with salt. 3 hours more to go on his watch. He made his way forward for another dipper of water, hoping it would help him stay on his feet. Dixon had left the captain and was strolling through the clusters of passengers, nodding to the men, stopping to say something to a woman with children.
Odd, Roger thought. The mate wasn't a sociable man with the crew, let alone with the passengers, whom he regarded as nothing more than an unusually inconvenient form of cargo.
Something stirred in his mind at the mention of cargo, something uncomfortable, but he couldn't bring it to the forefront of recognition. It hung in the shadows of exhaustion, just out of sight, nearly close enough to smell.
Yes, that was it. It had to do with a smell. But what...
"Mackenzie!"
One of the seamen was calling from the afterdeck, waving for him to come and help with the mending of sails torn by the storm. Huge stacks of folded canvas lay like dirty snowdrifts on the boards, their upper layers billowing in the wind. Roger groaned and stretched his aching muscles. No matter what happened in North Carolina, he would be very glad to get off this ship.
2 nights later, Roger was deep in dreams when the shouting roused him. His feet hit the deck and he was running for the companionway, heart pumping at full bore, before his mind had grasped the fact that he was awake. He sprang for the ladder, only to be knocked sprawling by a blow to his chest.
"Stay where you are, fool,"
Dixon's voice growled from the rungs above. He could see the mate's head outlined against the starry square of the hatchway overhead.
"What is it? What's happening?"
He shook off the confusion of his dreams to find no less confusion in the waking. There were others in the dark near him. He could feel bodies stumble over him as he struggled to his feet. All the noise was up above, though, a thunder of feet on the deck and a shouting and shrieking like nothing he'd ever heard.
"Murderers!"
A woman's voice cut through the racket, shrill as a fife.
"Wicked mur—"
The voice cut off abruptly, with a heavy thump on the deck above.
What is it?
On his feet again, Roger shoved his way through the men by the ladder, shouting up to Dixon.
What? Are we boarded?
His words were drowned by the shouting above, the steam whistle shrieks of women and children cutting through men's bellowing and curses. Red light flickered somewhere above. Was the ship afire? He shoved through the press of men and grabbed the ladder, reached up and seized Dixon's foot.
Get off!
The foot jerked free, aimed a kick at his head.
Stay down there. Christ, man, you want to catch pox? Pox? What the hell is going on up there?
Eyes accustomed to the dark by now, Roger grabbed the stabbing foot and gave it a vicious twist, jerked downward. Unprepared for assault, Dixon lost his grip on the ladder and fell heavily, sliding over Roger's head and into the men below. Roger ignored the cries of rage and surprise behind him and clambered out onto the deck. There was a group of men clustered thick about the forward hatchway. Lanterns hung above in the rigging, shooting beams of red and white and yellow light that caught the gleam of blades. He looked quickly for another ship, but the ocean was black and empty on all sides. No boarders, no pirates. All the struggle was taking place near the hatchway, where half the crew was gathered in a knot, armed with knives and clubs. Mutiny, he thought, and dismissed it, even as he pushed forward. Bonnet's head showed above the crowd, hatless, fair hair gleaming in the flash of lantern light. Roger shoved his way into the mob, ruthlessly shouldering smaller seamen aside. Shrieks and shouts echoed from the hold, and a flicker of light showed below. A bundle of rags was handed up, passed rapidly from hand to hand, disappeared behind the shifting mass of limbs and clubs. There was a heavy splash to port, and then another.
"What is it? What's happening?" he bellowed in the ear of the bosun, who stood near the hatchway holding a lantern. The man jerked round and glared at him. "You've not had pox, have you? Get below!"
Hutchinson's attention had already gone back to the open hatchway.
"Yes, I have. What's that got to—"
The bosun swung back, surprised.
"You've had pox? You're not marked? Ah, let it go. Get you down, then. We need all hands." "For what?"
Roger leaned forward to make himself heard above the noise from below.
"Smallpox," the bosun bellowed back.
He gestured at the open hatchway as one of the seamen appeared at the top of the ladder, a child under one arm, feebly kicking. Hands clawed and beat at the man's hunched back, and a woman's voice rose high above the other noises, shrill with terror. She got a grip on the seaman's blouse, and as Roger watched, she began to climb the man's body, dragging him backward as she struggled to reach the child, screaming as she clawed the man's back, digging handfuls of cloth and flesh. The man roared and swatted at her, trying to dislodge her. The ladder was fixed, but the seaman, one-handed and pulled off balance, swayed wildly, his look of rage turning to alarm as his feet slipped on the rung. Reflex alone made Roger lunge forward, grabbing the child like a rugger ball as the seaman threw his arms out in a last effort to save himself. Entangled like lovers, man and woman fell backward together into the open maw of the hatchway. There was a crash and more screams from below, then the sudden momentary silence of shock. Then the outcries began again below, and a muttering babble around him. Roger righted the child, trying to stop its whimpering with awkward pats. It seemed curiously loose-jointed in his arms, and it felt hot even through its layers of clothes. Light flashed over Roger as the bosun lifted his lantern high, looking at the child with distaste.
"Hope you have had the pox, Mackenzie," he said.
It was wee Gilbert, the lad with sore eyes, but 2 days had made such a change that Roger scarcely recognized him. The boy was thin as a wraith, the round face gone so thin that the skull bones showed. The fair, dirt-smudged skin had gone too, submerged under a mass of suppurating pustules so thick that the eyes were mere slits in the lolling head. He had barely time to register the sight before hands plucked the small, burning body from him. Before he could grasp the sudden emptiness in his arms, there was another splash to port. He swung toward the rail in vain reflex, hands curled in fists of shock, but then turned back as a new roar came from the hatchway behind. The passengers had recovered from the surprise of the attack. A rush of men boiled up the ladder, armed with anything they could seize, and fell upon the seamen at the top, bearing them down with sheer frenzy. Someone cannoned into Roger, and he fell, rolling to the side as a stool leg thudded into the deck near his head. He got to his hands and knees, was kicked in the ribs, shied, and was pushed, heaved back against obstruction, and with a moment's opportunity threw himself blindly at a pair of legs, having no idea whether he fought crew or passengers, fighting only for room to stand up and breathe. The stink of sickness rolled out of the hold, a sweet rotting smell that overlaid the usual harsh reek of ripe bodies and sewage. The lantern swung with the wind, and light and shadow cut the scene to pieces, so that here showed a face wild-eyed and shouting, there an arm upraised, here a naked foot, only to vanish in the darkness, and be replaced at once by elbows and knives and thrusting knees, so that the deck seemed awash in dismembered bodies. So strong was the confusion that Roger felt dismembered himself. He glanced down, feeling numbness in his left arm, half expecting to find the limb struck off. It was there, though, and he raised it by reflex, fending off an unseen blow that jarred through bone. Someone grasped his hair. He jerked free and swung round, elbowed someone hard in the ribs and swung again, hitting air. He found himself momentarily standing clear of the fight, gasping for breath. Two figures crouched before him in the shadow of the rail. As he shook his head to clear it, the taller stood up and launched itself at him. He reeled backward under the impact, clutching his attacker. They struck the foremast and fell together, then rolled over and over, hammering each other in blind earnest. Caught in the web of noise and blows, he paid no mind to the disjointed words that panted in his ear. Then a boot struck him, and another, and as he loosed his hold on his opponent, two crewmen kicked them apart. Someone seized the other man and pulled him upright, and Roger saw the flash of the bosun's lantern held high, revealing the face of the tall, fair-haired passenger, Morag Mackenzie's husband, green eyes dark and wild with fury. Mackenzie was the worse for wear, so was Roger, as he discovered when he passed a hand across his face and felt his split lip. But his skin was clear of pustules.
"Good enough," said Hutchison briefly,
and the man was thrust unceremoniously toward the hatchway. His comrades gave Roger a rough hand up, and then left him swaying, dazed and ignored, as they finished their work. The resistance had been short-lived. Though armed with the fury of despair, the passengers were weakened by 6 weeks under hatches, by sickness and scanty food. The stronger had been clubbed into submission, the weaker forced back, and those sick of pox. Roger looked out at the rail and the path of the moon's isle, serene on the water. He grabbed the rail and vomited, retching till no more than bile came up, burning the back of nose and throat. The water below was black and empty. Drained and shaking from exertion, he made his way slowly across the deck. Those seamen he passed were silent, but from the battened forward hatchway, a single thin wail rose up and up, an endless keen that drew no breath and knew no respite. He nearly fell down the companionway into the crew's quarters, went to his hammock, ignoring all questions, and wrapped his blanket over his head, trying to shut out the sound of the wailing, to shut out everything. But there was no oblivion to be found in the suffocating woolen folds, and he jerked the blanket off, heart pounding, with a sensation of drowning so strong in his chest that he gulped air again and again until he felt dizzy, and still breathed deep, as though he must breathe for those who could not.
"It's for the best, lad,"
Hutchison had said to him with gruff sympathy, passing by as he puked his guts out over the rail.
"Pox spreads like wildfire. None in that hold would live to make landfall, did we not take out the sick."
And was this better than the slower death of scabs and fever?
Not for those left behind.
The wail went on and on, lancing the silence, piercing wood and heart alike. Maimed pictures flashed in his mind, truncated scenes caught by the popping of invisible flashbulbs. The sailor's contorted face as he fell into the hold. the little boy's half-open mouth, the inside scabbed with pustules. Bonnet standing above the fray, with his face of a fallen angel watching. And the dark, hungry water, empty under the moon. Something bumped softly, sliding past the hull, and he rolled into a shivering ball, oblivious alike to the sweltering heat in the hold and the sleepy complaint of the man next to him. No, not empty. He had heard the seamen say that sharks never sleep.
Oh, God, he said aloud. Oh, God.
He should have been praying for the dead, but could not. He rolled again, squirming, trying to escape, and in the echo of the futile prayer found memory. The misplaced hearing of those few frantic words panted in his ear during those moments of unthinking frenzy.
"For the love of God, man," the fair-haired man had said. "For the love of God, let her go."
He straightened and lay stiff, bathed in cold sweat. Two figures in the shadow, and the open hatchway to the stores hold some 20 feet away.
"Oh, God," he said again.
But this time it was a prayer. It was the middle of the dog watch next day before Roger found an opportunity to go down to the hold. He made no effort to avoid being seen. Watching his shipmates had taught him quickly that in close quarters nothing drew attention faster than furtiveness. If anyone asked, he had heard a bumping noise, and thought perhaps the load had shifted. Close enough to be the truth at that. He hung from the edge of the hatch by his hands, less chance of being followed if he didn't put down the ladder. He dropped into the dark and landed hard, jarring his bones. Anyone down there would have heard that, and by the same token, if anyone followed him, he would be warned. He took a moment to recover from the shock of landing, then began to move cautiously through the looming dim bulks of the stacked cargo. Everything seemed blurred round the edges. It wasn't only the faint light, he thought. Everything in the hold was vibrating very slightly, thrumming to the shiver of the hull beneath. He could hear it, if he listened closely, the lowest note in the ship's song. Through the narrow aisles, between the ranks of crates, past the huge bellies of the serried water casks. He breathed in. The air was full of the smell of wet wood, overlaid by the faint perfume of tea. There were rustlings and creakings, plenty of odd noises, but no sign of any human presence. Still, he was sure that someone was here. "And why are you here, mate?" he thought. What if one of the steerage passengers had taken refuge here? If someone lay hidden here, chances were good that they had the pox. Roger could do nothing for them. Why bother to look? Because he couldn't not look, was the answer. He didn't reproach himself for failing to save the pox-ridden passengers. Nothing could have helped them in any case, and perhaps a quick death by drowning was not in fact more terrible than the slow agony of the disease. He'd like to believe that. But he hadn't slept. The events of the night filled him with such a sense of horror and sick futility that he could find no rest. Whether he could do anything now or not, he must do something. He had to look. Something small moved in the deep shadow of the hold. Rat, he thought, and turned reflexively to stamp on it. The movement saved him. A heavy object whizzed past his head and landed with a splash in the bilges below. He put his head down and lunged in the direction of the movement, shoulders hunched against an expected blow. There was nowhere to run and not much place to hide. He saw it again, lunged and grabbed cloth, jerked hard and got flesh. A quick scuffle in the dark and a cry of alarm, and he found himself pressing a body hard against a bulkhead, clutching the skinny wrist of Morag Mackenzie.
"What the hell?"
She kicked at him and tried to bite, but he ignored this. He got a good grip on the scruff of her neck and hauled her out of the shadows into the dim brown light of the hold.
"What are you doing here?"
"Nothing. Let go. Let me go, please. Please. I beg you, sir." Force not availing to free herself, she weighed perhaps half what he did. She turned to pleading, words pouring out in a half-whispered stream of desperation.
"For the sake of your own mother, sir, you cannot do it. Please, you cannot let them kill him. Please."
"I'm not going to kill anyone."
"For God's sake, hush yourself," he said,
and gave her a small shake. From the blackest shadows behind the anchor chain came the high, thin wail of a fretful baby. She gave a small gasp and looked up at him, frantic.
"They'll hear him. God, man, let me go to him."
Such was her desperation that she succeeded in wrenching herself free and fled toward the sound, clambering over the great rusted links of the anchor chain, heedless of filth. He followed, more slowly. She couldn't get away. There was nowhere for her to go. He found them in the darkest spot, crouched against one of the ship's knees, the huge angled timbers that framed the hull. There was barely a foot of clearance between the rough wood of the hull and the piled mass of the anchor chain. She was no more than a darker blot on the Stygian blackness.
"I will not hurt you," he said softly.
The shadow seemed to shrink away from him, but she didn't answer. His eyes were slowly growing accustomed to the dark. Even back here, a faint light seeped through from the distant hatch. A patch of white. Her breast was bared, giving suck to the child. He could hear the small wet noises as it fed.
"What in the hell are you doing here?" he asked,
though he knew well enough. His stomach clenched tight, and not just because of the foul smell of the bilges. He squatted next to her, barely able to fit in the tiny space.
"I'm hiding,"
she said fiercely.
"Surely to goodness you see that."
"Is the child sick?"
"No!"
She hunched herself over the baby, squirming as far away from him as she...
"Then..."
"It's no but a wee rash. Old bairns get them. My mither said so."
He could hear the fear in her voice underneath the furious denial.
"Are you sure?"
he said, as gently as he could. He reached a tentative hand toward the dark blotch she held. She struck at him, awkwardly one-handed, and he jerked back with a hiss of pain.
"Jesus! You stabbed me!"
"Stay back! Of my husband's dirk," she warned. "I won't let you take him. I'll kill you first. I swear I will."
He believed her. Hand to his mouth, he could taste his own blood, sweet and salt on his tongue. It was no more than a scratch, but he believed her. She'd kill him, or die herself, which was a great deal more likely if one of the crew found her. But no, he thought. She was worth money.
Bonnet wouldn't kill her, only have her dragged on deck and forced to watch as her child was torn out of her arms and thrown into the sea.
He remembered the dark shadows that dogged the ship, and shuddered with a cold that had nothing to do with the dank surroundings.
"I won't take him. But if it's the pox..."
"It's not. I swear to bride, it's not."
A small hand shot out of the shadows and gripped him by the sleeve.
"It's as I tell you. It's no but a milk rash. I've seen it, man, 100 times before. I'm the eldest of 9. I ken well enough when a bairn's sick and when he's but teething."
He hesitated, then made up his mind abruptly. If she was wrong, and the child had smallpox, she was likely already infected. To return her to the hold would be only to spread the disease. And if she was right, he knew as well as she that it didn't matter. Any rash would condemn the child on sight. He could feel her quivering on the brink of hysteria. He wanted to touch her in reassurance, but thought better of it. She wouldn't trust him, and no wonder.
"I won't give you away," he whispered.
He was met by suspicious silence.
"You need food, don't you? And fresh water. You'll have no milk soon without it. And then what of the bairn?"
He could hear her breathing, ragged and phlegmy. She was ill, but it needn't be pox. All the hold passengers coughed and wheezed. The damp had got into their lungs early on.
"Show him to me."
"No!"
Her eyes shone in the dark, fearful as a cornered rat's, and the edge of her lip lifted over small white teeth.
"I swear I will not take him from you. I need to see, though."
"What will you swear on?"
He groped in his memory for a suitable Celtic oath, then gave up and said what was in his mind.
"On my own woman's life," he said, "and on the heads of my unborn sons."
He could feel doubt, and then a small easing of the tension in her. The round knee pressed against his leg moved slightly as she relaxed. There was a stealthy rustling in the chains nearby. Real rats this time.
"I canna leave him here alone while I steal food." He saw the faint tilt of her head toward the noise. "They'll eat him alive. They've bitten me in my sleep already, the filthy vermin."
He reached out his hands, conscious all the time of the sounds from the deck above. It wasn't likely that anyone would come down here, but how long before he was missed above? She still hesitated, but at last reached a finger toward her breast and freed the child's mouth with a tiny pop. It made a small sound of protest and wriggled slightly as he took it. He hadn't held babies very often. The feel of the dirty little bundle was startling. Inert but lively, soft yet firm.
"Mind his head?"
"I've got it."
Cradling the warm round skull in one careful palm, he duck-walked backward a step or two, bringing the child's face into dim light. The cheeks were splotched with reddish pustules, topped with white. They looked for all the world like pox to Roger, and he felt a tremor of revulsion in the palms of his hands. Immunity or not, it took courage to touch contagion and not flinch. He squinted at the child, then carefully undid its wrappings, ignoring the mother's hissed protest. He slid a hand under its dress, feeling first the soggy clout that hung between its chubby legs, and then the smooth, silky skin of chest and stomach. The child didn't really seem so sick. His eyes were clear, not gummy. And while the tiny boy seemed feverish, it wasn't the searing heat he had felt the night before. The baby whined and squirmed, true, but he kicked with a fretful strength in the tiny limbs, not the weak spasms of a dying child.
"The very young go quickly," Claire had said. "You have no notion how fast disease moves when there's nothing to fight it with."
He had some notion, after last night.
"All right," he whispered at last. "I think you're maybe right."
He felt, rather than saw, the easing of her arm. She had held her dagger ready. He gingerly handed back the child, with a mingled sense of relief and reluctance, and the terrifying realization of the responsibility he had accepted. Morag was cooing to the boy, cuddling him against her breast as she hastily rewrapped him.
"Sweet Jimmy, aye, that's a good laddie. Hush, Bitty. Hush now. It'll be all right. Mammy's here for you."
"How long?" Roger whispered, laying a hand on her arm. "How long will the rash last, if it's milk rash?"
"Maybe 4 days. Maybe 5, she whispered back. "But it's no but maybe 2 more, and the rash will be different. Less. Anyone can see then that it's not the pox. I can come out then."
2 days. If it was pox, the child would be dead in 2 days. But if not, he might just manage. And so might she.
"Can you keep a week that long? The rats?"
"Aye, I can," she said fiercely.
"I can do what I must. Will you help me then?"
He drew a deep breath, ignoring the stench.
"Aye, I will."
He stood up and gave her his hand. After a moment's hesitation, she took it and stood too. She was small, she barely reached his shoulder, and her hand in his was the size of a child's. In the shadows, she looked like a young girl cradling her doll.
"How old are you?" he asked suddenly.
He caught the gleam of her eyes, surprised, and then the flash of teeth.
"Yesterday I was 22, she said dryly. "Today... and maybe 100.
The small damp hand pulled free of his, and she melted back into the darkness. Chapter 39. A Gambling Man.
The fog gathered through the night. By dawn, the ship rode in a cloud so thick that the sea below couldn't be seen from the rail, and only the susurrus of the hull's passage indicated that the Gloriana still floated on water, not air.
There was no sun and little wind. The sails hung limp, shuddering now and then with a passing air. Oppressed by the dimness, men walked the decks like ghosts, appearing out of the murk with a suddenness that startled one another. This obscurity served Roger well. He was able to pass almost unseen through the ship and slip unobserved into the hold, the small store of food he had kept back from his own meals concealed in his shirt. The fog had gotten into the hold as well. Clammy white tendrils touched his face, drifting out between the looming water casks, and hovered near his feet. It was darker than ever here below, gone from dusty gold dimness to the black brown of cold, wet wood. The child was asleep. Roger saw no more than the curve of its cheek still spattered with red pustules. They looked angry and inflamed. Morag saw his look of doubt and said nothing, but took his hand in her own and pressed it to the baby's neck. The tiny pulse went bump, bump, bump under his finger, and the soft, creased skin was warm but damp. Reassured, he smiled at Morag, and she gave him back a tiny glimmer. A month in steerage had left her thin and grimy. The last 2 days had stamped her face with permanent lines of fear. Her hair straggled lank around her face, caked with grease and thick with lice. Her eyes were bruised with tiredness, and she smelled of feces and urine, sour milk and stale sweat. Her lips were tight and pale as the rest of her face. Roger took her very gently by the shoulders, bent, and kissed her mouth. At the top of the ladder he looked back. She was still standing there, looking up at him, the child in her arms. The deck was quiet, save for the murmur of helmsman and bosun, invisible at the wheel. Roger eased the hatch cover back in place, his heart beginning to slow again, the touch of her still warming his hands. 2 days, maybe three. Perhaps they would make it. Roger, at least, was convinced she was right. The child did not have pox. There should be no occasion for anyone to go into the hold soon. A freshwater cask had been brought up only the day before. He could continue to feed her, if only she could stay awake long enough. The sharp ting of the ship's bell pierced the fog, a reminder of time that no longer seemed to exist, its passage unmarked by any change of light or dark. It was as Roger crossed toward the stern that he heard it, a sudden loud whoosh in the mist off the rail, very near at hand. The next instant the ship trembled slightly underfoot, her boards brushed by something huge. "Whale!" came a cry from aloft. He could see two men near the mainmast, dimly outlined in the fog. At the cry they froze, and he realized that he too was standing rigid, listening. There was another whoosh nearby, another farther off. The crew of the Gloriana stood silent, each man charting in his head the great exhalations, marking an invisible map on which the ship drifted through moving shoals, mountains of silent, intelligent flesh. How big were they? Roger wondered. Big enough to damage the ship? He strained his eyes, vainly trying to see anything at all through the fog. It came again. A thump hard enough to jar the rail under his hands, followed by a long, grating rasp that shuddered through the boards. There were muffled cries of fear from below. To those in the steerage it would be right next to them, no more than the planks of the hull between them and rupture, a sudden smash, and the frightful inrush of the sea. 3-inch oak planks seemed no more substantial than tissue paper against the great beasts that floated nearby, breathing unseen in the fog. "Barnacles," said a soft Irish voice from the mist behind him. Despite himself, Roger jumped, and a low chuckle materialized into Bonnet's shadowed bulk. The captain held a cheroot between his teeth, a spill from the galley fire illumining the lines and planes of his face, dissolute in red light. The rasping shudder came again through the boards. "They scratch themselves to rid their skins of parasites," Bonnet said casually. "We are no more to them than a floating stone." He drew heavily to start the flame, blew fragrant smoke, and tossed the burning paper overboard. It vanished in the mist like a falling star. Roger let out a breath only slightly less noisy than the whales. How close had Bonnet been? Had the captain seen him coming out of the hold?
"They'll not damage the ship, then," he said, matching the captain's casual tone.
Bonnet smoked for a moment in silence, concentrating on the draw of his cigar. Without the illumination of the open flame, he was once more a shadow, marked only by the glowing coal of the tip.
"Who knows?" he said at last, small spurts of smoke puffing out between his teeth as he spoke. "Any one of the beasts might sink us, should he have a mind in him for mischief. I saw a ship once, or what was left of it, battered to pieces by an angry whale. 3 feet of board and a bit of spar left floating. Sunk with all hands, 200 souls."
"You don't seem troubled by the possibility."
There was a long sound of exhalation, a faint echo of the whale's sighing, as Bonnet blew smoke between pursed lips.
"'Twould be a waste of strength to worry myself. A wise man leaves those things beyond his power to the gods, and prays that Dunno will be with him."
The edge of the captain's hat turned toward him.
"You'll know of Dunno, will you, Mackenzie?"
"Dunno," Roger said stupidly. And then the penny dropped, an old chant coming back to him from the mists of childhood, something Mrs. Graham had taught him to say.
"Come to me, Dunno, change my luck, make me bold, give me wealth and love to hold."
There was an amused grunt behind the coal.
"Ah, and you not even an Irishman. But sure, I knew you from the first for a man of learning, Mackenzie." "I know Dunno the luck-giver," Roger said, hoping against hope that that particular Celtic goddess was both a good sailor and on his side.
He took a step backward, meaning to go, but a hand descended on his wrist, holding tight.
"A man of learning," Bonnet repeated softly, all levity gone from his voice. "But no wisdom. And are you a praying man at all, Mackenzie?"
He tensed, but felt the force of Bonnet's grip and didn't pull away. Strength gathered in his limbs, his body knowing before he did that the fight had come.
"I said, a wise man doesn't trouble himself with things beyond his power. But on this ship, Mackenzie, everything is in my power."
The grip on his wrist tightened.
"And everyone."
Roger jerked his wrist sideways, breaking the grip. He stood alone, knowing there was neither help nor escape. There was no world beyond the ship. And within it, Bonnet was right. All were in the captain's power. If he died, it wouldn't help Morag. But that choice was made already.
"Why?" said Bonnet, sounding only mildly interested. "The woman's no looker, surely. And a man of such learning, too. Would you risk my ship and my venture, then, only for the sake of a warm body?"
"No risk."
The words came out hoarse, forced through a tight throat.
"Come at me," he thought, and his hands curled at his sides. "Come at me and give me a chance to take you with me. The child doesn't have pox. A harmless rash." "You'll forgive me my putting my ignorant opinion above your own, Mr. Mackenzie. But I am captain here."
The voice was still soft, but the venom was clear.
"That's a child, for God's sake." "It is. And of no value."
"No value to you, perhaps."
There was a moment's silence, broken only by a distant whoosh in the empty white.
"And what value to you?"
the voice asked, implacable.
"Why?"
"For the sake of a warm body."
"Yes, for that. For the touch of humanity, the memory of tenderness, for the feeling of life stubborn in the face of death."
"For pity," he said. "She's poor. There's no one to help her."
The rich perfume of tobacco reached him, narcotic, enchanting. He breathed it in, taking strength from it. Bonnet moved, and he moved too, settling himself in preparation. But there was no blow forthcoming. The shadow dug in a pocket, held out a ghostly hand in which he caught a magpie glitter from the diffuse lantern light, coins and bits of rubbish, and what might have been a jewel's quick gleam. Then the captain plucked out a silver shilling and thrust the rest back into his pocket.
"Ah, pity," he said. "And did you say you were a gambling man at all, Mackenzie?"
He held out the shilling, dropped it. Roger caught it, only by reflex.
"For the suckling's life, then," Bonnet said.
And the tone of light amusement was back.
"A gentleman's wager, shall we call it. Heads it lives, and tails it dies."
The coin was warm and solid in his palm, an alien thing in this world of drifting chill. His hands were slick with sweat, and yet his mind had gone cold and sharp, focused to an ice-pick's point.
"Heads he lives, and tails he dies," he thought,
quite calmly, and didn't mean the child below. He marked throat and crotch on the other man, grip and lunge, a blow and a heave, and the rail was no more than a foot away, the empty realm of the whales beyond. There was no room beyond his calculations for any sense of fear. He saw the coin spin up as though it were thrown by another hand, then fall to the deck. His muscles bunched themselves slowly.
"It seems Dunno is with you the night, sir."
Bonnet's soft Irish voice seemed to come to him from a great way off as the captain bent and picked up the coin.
Realization was only beginning to bloom in his chest when the captain gripped his shoulder, turning him down the deck. "You'll walk with me a while, Mackenzie."
Something had happened to his knees. He felt as though he would sink down with every step, and yet somehow stayed upright, keeping pace with the shadow. The ship was silent, the deck under his feet a mile away, but the sea beyond was a live thing, breathing. He felt the breath in his own lungs rise and fall with the shifting deck, and felt as though there were no boundaries to his body. It might have been wood under his feet, or water, for all he could feel. It was some time before he made sense of Bonnet's words, and realized, with a vague sense of amazement, that the man seemed to be recounting the story of his life, in a quiet, matter-of-fact sort of way. Orphaned in Sligo at an early age, he had learned quickly to fend for himself, he said, working as a cabin boy aboard trading ships. But one winter, with ships scarce, he had found work ashore in Inverness, digging the foundation for a grand house that was building near the town.
"I was just 17, he said. "The youngest of the crew of workmen. I couldn't say why it was they hated me. Maybe it was my manner, for that was rough enough, or jealousy for my size and strength. They were an unchancy, whey-faced lot. Or maybe that the lasses smiled on me. Or maybe 'twas only that I was a stranger. Still, I knew well enough I was unpopular with them. Little did I know quite how unpopular, though, until the day the cellar was finished and the foundation ready to be laid."
Bonnet paused to draw on his cigar, lest it go out. He let out puffs of smoke from the corners of his mouth, white wisps that curled past his head into the greater white of the fog.
"The trenches were dug," he went on, the cigar clenched between his teeth, "and the walls started. The great block of the cornerstone standin' ready. I'd gone to my supper, and was just walking back to the place where I slept, when to my surprise, I was caught up by a pair of the lads with whom I worked. They'd a bottle. They sat down on a wall and urged me to drink with them. I should have known better, for they were friendly, which they'd never been before. But I did drink, and drink again. And in no time at all I was reelin' drunk, for I'd no head for liquor, having never the money to buy strong drink. I was well fuddled by the time 'twas full dark, and scarcely thought to pull away when they took me by the arms and hastened me down the lane. Then they seized me, tossed me over a half-built wall, and to my surprise, I found myself lying in the damp dirt of the cellar I'd helped dig. All of them were there, the workmen. Another man was with them, too. One of them had a lantern, and when he held it up, I could see the man was Daft Joey. Daft Joey was a beggarman that lived beneath the bridge. He had nae teeth, and he ate rotten fish and floating dung from the river, and he stank worse than a blackbirder's hold.
I was so dazed with the whiskey and the fall that I lay where I was, only half hearing them as they talked, or argued, rather. For the chief of the gang was angry that the two had brought me. The dafty would do, he said. A mercy to him at that. But them that brought me said, no, better me. Someone might miss the beggarman, they said. And then someone laughed and said aye, and they wouldn't have to pay me my last week's wages. And 'twas then I began to know they meant to kill me. They talked before, while we worked. A sacrifice, they said, for the foundation, lest the earth tremble and the walls collapse. But I hadn't listened, and if I had, wouldn't have guessed that they meant any more than to chop the head off a cockerel and bury it, as was usual.
He hadn't looked at Roger through this recital, his eyes instead fixed on the mist, as though the events he described were happening again, somewhere just beyond the white curtain of fog. Roger's clothing hung on him, clinging, wringing wet with mist and cold sweat. His stomach clenched, and the cesspool smell of the steerage might have been the stink of Daft Joey in the cellar.
So they palavered for a bit, Bonnet went on, and the beggarman began to make noise, for he wanted more drink. And at last the chief said it wasn't worth so much talk. He would throw for the choice. Then he took a coin from his pocket, and he said to me, laughing, "Will you take head or tails then, man?" I was too sick to say a word. The sky was black and whirling round, and bits of light kept flickering at the edges of my eyes like fallen stars. So he said it for me. By Geordie's head should I live, and by his arse I should die. And he threw the shilling up in the air. It came down in the dirt by my head, and I hadn't any strength to turn and look. He bent to see and gave a grunt, and he stood up and took nae more notice of me.
They had reached the stern in their quiet pacing. Bonnet stopped there, hands on the rail, smoking silently. Then he took the cigar from his mouth.
They pulled the dafty to the wall that was built and made him sit down on the ground at its foot. "I do remember his foolish face," he said softly. He took a drink, and he laughed with them. And his mouth was open, slack and wet as an old whore's cunt. The next moment the stone came down from the top of the wall and crushed his head.
Drops of moisture had gathered on the spikes of hair at the back of Roger's neck. He could feel them run down, one at a time, trickling cold down the crease of his back.
"They rolled me on my face and hit me," Bonnet continued matter-of-factly. "When I came to myself again, I was in the bottom of a fishing boat. The fisherman left me on the shore near Peterhead, and said he would advise me to find a new ship. He could see, he said, I was not meant for the land."
He held up the cigar and tapped it gently with a finger to loosen the ash.
"At that," he said, "they did give me wages. When I came to look, the shilling was in my pocket. Ah, they were honest men, sure."
Roger leaned against the rail, gripping its wood as the single solid thing in a world gone soft and nebulous.
"And did you go back to the land?" he asked,
and heard his own voice, preternaturally calm, as though it belonged to someone else.
"Did I find them, you mean?"
Bonnet turned and leaned back against the rail, half facing Roger.
"Oh, yes, years later, one at a time. But I found them all."
He opened the hand that held the coin, and held it cupped thoughtfully before him, tilting it back and forth, so the silver gleamed in the lantern light.
"Heads you live, and tails you die. A fair chance, would you say, Mackenzie?"
"For them."
"For you."
The soft Irish voice was as unemphatic as it might be, were it making observations of the weather. As in a dream, Roger felt the weight of the shilling drop once more into his hands. He heard the suck and hiss of the water on the hull, the blowing of the whales, and the suck and hiss of Bonnet's breath as he drew on his cigar. 7 whales, the fill of a Keithan crone.
"A fair chance," Bonnet said. "Luck was with you before, Mackenzie. See, will Danu come for you again? Or will it be the soul-eater this time?"
The fog had closed over the deck. There was nothing visible save the glowing coal of Bonnet's cigar, a burning cyclops in the mist. The man might be a devil indeed, one eye closed to human misery, one eye open to the dark. And here Roger stood quite literally between the devil and the deep blue sea, with his fate shining silver in the palm of his hand.
"It's my life. I'll make the call," he said,
and was surprised to hear his voice calm and steady.
"Tails. Tails is mine."
He threw and caught, clapped his one hand hard against the back of the other, trapped the coin and its unknown sentence. He closed his eyes and thought just once of Brianna.
"I'm sorry,"
he said silently to her, and lifted his hand. A warm breath passed over his skin, and then he felt a spot of coolness on the back of his hand as the coin was picked up. But he didn't move, didn't open his eyes. It was some time before he realized that he stood alone. Part 9. Passionnément. Chapter 40. Virgin Sacrifice. Wilmington, the colony of North Carolina, September the 1st, 1769. This was the third attack of whatever Lizzie's sickness was. She had seemed to recover after the first bad fever, and after a day spent regaining her strength, had insisted she was able to travel. They'd got no more than a day's ride north of Charleston, though, before the fever struck again. Brianna had hobbled the horses and made a hasty camp near a small creek, then made trip after trip through the night, scrabbling up and down a muddy bank in the dark, carrying water in a small canteen to dribble down Lizzie's throat and over her steaming body. She wasn't afraid of dark woods or lurking animals, but the thought of Lizzie dying in the wilderness, miles from any sort of help, was terrifying enough to make her want to head straight back to Charleston as soon as Lizzie could sit a horse. By morning, however, the fever had broken, and though Lizzie was weak and pale, she had been able to ride. Brianna had hesitated, but finally decided to press on toward Wilmington, rather than turn back. The urge that had driven her all this way now had a sharper spur. She had to find her mother, for Lizzie's sake as well as her own. Brianna hadn't appreciated her size for most of her life spent looming in the back row of class pictures, but she'd begun to feel the advantages of height and strength as she grew older. And the longer she spent in this miserable place, the more advantageous they seemed. She braced one arm against the bed frame as she eased the chamber pot out from under Lizzie's frail white buttocks with the other hand. Lizzie was scrawny but surprisingly heavy, and no more than half conscious. She moaned and twitched restlessly, the twitch suddenly springing into the full-fledged convulsions of a chill. The shivering was beginning to ease a little now, though Lizzie's teeth were still clenched hard enough to make the sharp bones of her jaws stand out like struts beneath her skin. Malaria, Brianna thought for the dozenth time. It must be, to keep coming back like this. A number of small pink welts showed on Lizzie's neck, reminders of the mosquitoes that had plagued them ever since the Philip Alonso drew within sight of land. They had made landfall too far south, and wasted 3 weeks in meandering through the shallow coastal waters to Charleston, gnawed incessantly by blood-sucking bugs. "There now. Feeling a little better?" Lizzie nodded feebly and tried to smile, succeeding only in looking like a white mouse that had taken poisoned bait. "Water, honey. Try a little. Just a sip." Brianna held the cup to Lizzie's mouth, coaxing. She felt a strange sense of déjà vu, and realized that her voice was the echo of her mother's, both in words and tone. The realization was oddly comforting, as though her mother somehow stood behind her, speaking through her. If it were her mother speaking, though, next would have come the orange-flavored St. Joseph's aspirin, a tiny pill to be sucked and savored as much treat as medicine, the aches and fever seeming to subside as quickly as the sweet, tart pill dissolved on her tongue. Brianna cast a bleak glance at her saddlebags bulging in the corner. No aspirin there. Jenny had sent a small bundle of what she called simples, but the